Welcome back to the deep dive. I want to start today with a word that you probably hear, oh, I don't know, 10 or 20 times a day.
At least.
Yeah, at least. And you likely just don't give it a second thought. It's one of those invisible words that just blends completely into the background noise of everyday life.
Right.
Volume.
It's deceptive, really. It
Right.
feels incredibly mundane.
It really does. I mean, usually when I say volume, or when you see it on a screen, you're just reaching for the remote to turn up the TV because you can't hear the dialogue over the music.
Exactly. Or maybe you're in the shower looking at the back of a shampoo bottle, trying to figure out if you have enough left for one more wash.
Yeah, but today we are not talking about sound waves. We aren't talking about decibels at all.
No, we are talking about space.
Space.
The fundamental fabric of our reality, the room you are sitting in right now, the coffee cup in your hand, the air in your lungs, all of it is defined by volume.
Exactly. We're talking about the amount of three-dimensional space that stuff occupies. And I have to admit, when I first looked at the stack of research you sent over for this, I was a little skeptical.
You thought it was going to be boring.
Well, I just thought, okay, length times width times height.
Right.
How hard can this be? We'll be done with this deep dive in 5 minutes. It's a box.
And
Done.
then you fell down the rabbit hole.
I fell down a very deep, very geometric, and surprisingly political rabbit hole.
It really is.
Because it turns out the story of how we measure volume isn't just about math. It's about survival. It's about kings trying not to get overthrown by angry peasants.
Right, taxation.
Yeah, and ancient Egyptian payroll disputes. And eventually, it's about the speed of light and the fundamental constants of the universe.
That is the arc, really. It's a journey from survival estimation.
Just trying to make sure you have enough food to not starve this winter.
Exactly. Going from that to universal precision.
So that is our mission today. We're going to trace that exact arc. We're going to go from measuring grain with actual pig stomachs,
Which is fascinating.
which, yes, is a real thing we need to discuss in detail. We're going from pig stomachs to calculating the volume of a digital dolphin using calculus.
And along the way, we really need to clarify what we are actually measuring, because volume is a slippery term. It gets used in a lot of different contexts.
Yeah, so let's ground that definition right now. When a scientist or a mathematician says volume, what are they strictly referring to?
Strictly speaking, volume is the measure of the amount of three-dimensional space enclosed by a closed surface.
Okay, closed surface. That sounds a bit technical. Break that down for us.
Sure. Imagine any object, a box, a ball, a coffee cup, a planet. Volume is the amount of space that object occupies. It's the bigness of the object in 3D space.
Right.
Now, this usually gets quantified numerically. If you're using the metric system, the SI units, you were talking about cubic meters or liters.
And if you're in the US, like many of us, you are dealing with the absolute chaos of gallons and quarts, fluid ounces, cubic inches, bushels, pecs.
It's a lot. We will get to the chaos of units later.
Bet.
But before we do, there's an important distinction we need to make right off the bat. It's the difference between the volume of the container itself and the space it displaces.
Okay.
Or, more commonly, the distinction between volume and capacity.
Okay, yeah, let's unpack that because I use those words interchangeably all the time. I'll say, what's the volume of this gas tank? When I really mean, how much gas can I put inside it?
And in casual conversation, that's perfectly fine. We know what you mean. But in physics and engineering, and definitely in history, the distinction is crucial.
So, what is the difference?
Volume is the space the object displaces. Capacity is the space the object contains.
Give me a visual.
Think of a hollow steel box.
Got it.
The capacity is the amount of air inside it, how much stuff you can pack into it. That might be huge. But the volume of the box itself,
The actual steel walls.
right, the amount of steel used to make it, that is relatively small. Now, imagine if you took a hydraulic press and crushed that box into a solid ball of metal.
Okay, so now it's just a dense lump.
Exactly. The
Yeah.
capacity has dropped to zero. It can't hold anything anymore.
But the volume.
The volume of the steel, the actual amount of space the metal occupies in the universe, remains exactly the same.
Okay, that really helps. So, like, a sponge has a certain volume of sponge material, but a high capacity for water because of all the holes.
Precisely. And that distinction becomes very important when you start doing things like shipping oil or calculating buoyancy or trying to figure out if a ship will float.
Right.
But generally, the history of volume is the history of people trying to figure out capacity, asking, how much grain is in this jar?
Which brings us to the tone of today's deep dive. I have to say, looking through the research, I was totally surprised by how much drama there is in the history of volume.
Oh, absolutely.
You have kings passing laws. You have ancient Egyptian scribes sweating over payroll. You have Archimedes jumping out of bathtubs.
It wasn't just drama, though. It was a genuine struggle for consistency.
Right.
You have to remember, for most of human history, we didn't have a leader, we didn't have a gallon, we just had to survive.
And survival meant knowing how much grain you had for the winter.
Exactly. So the history of volume is really the history of civilization trying to organize itself.
So let's go back to that struggle. Section one of our deep dive, the ancient struggle for accuracy.
Let's do it.
We are starting way back. Before the metric system, before standardized measuring cups, if I am a farmer in, say, 3000 BCE, and I need to trade you some wheat for a goat, how do we figure out how much wheat I'm actually giving you?
You use what you have, and what you have is your body and nature.
Okay.
The oldest methods of measuring volume were purely based on the human form, anthropomorphic measurements.
The handful method.
Literally.
Mm.
You might use a handful.
Mm.
You might use a double handful. You might use a pinch.
Which sounds charmingly rustic until you think about the actual economics of it.
It's a disaster for economics. Imagine we're at a market in ancient Mesopotamia. I'm selling saffron, which is incredibly expensive. And I say the price is 2 handfuls for a silver coin.
And I show up with hands the size of baseball mitts.
Exactly. I go broke.
Yeah.
Or if I'm the seller and I have tiny hands, you act like I'm ripping you off. The subjectivity of the human body is a terrible standard for trade.
It just leads to arguments.
It leads to mistrust. It is impossible to build a stable economy on handfuls.
So they needed something outside the body, something more consistent.
They looked to nature. Gourds were very common. A dried gourd is essentially a natural bottle.
But again, no two gourds are identical.
Exactly. So then they turned to biology.
And this is where the pig stomachs come in.
And sheep bladders.
I have to stop you there. Why? Just why?
It's actually very logical if you are a hunter-gatherer or an early pastoralist. You are butchering animals for food anyway. You have these organs left over.
I guess that makes sense.
A bladder or a stomach is a naturally sealed, waterproof container. Evolution basically designed them to hold volume.
Right, to hold fluids or food.
And within a specific species of animal, they're roughly the same size.
Roughly being the operative word there. I really can't imagine two sheep stomachs are exactly the same size down to the milliliter.
Oh, they definitely aren't. The source notes that precision in the ancient period usually ranged between 10 to 50 milliliters.
That's a pretty wide margin of error.
It's about 1 to 2 fluid ounces.
Wow.
So imagine buying a pint of beer and getting 2 ounces less than you paid for.
That would definitely cause a bar fight today.
Indeed it would. But in a hunter-gatherer society or early agriculture, that margin was acceptable.
It was the best they had.
Right. It's when you start building cities and empires that rough stops working. You need to pay workers. You need to tax farmers.
You can't tax someone based on a gourd of wheat if every single gourd is different.
Exactly. And this is where we see the shift to the big civilizations, ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia.
Yeah, the source material mentions the Moscow Mathematical Papyrus from around 1820 BCE. That sounds incredibly specific.
It is. This is one of our oldest pieces of evidence for volume calculation. It shows that the Egyptians weren't just guessing. They were doing actual math.
They were solving problems to approximate the volume of simple shapes.
Right. They looked at cuboids, cylinders, even frustums.
Okay, a frustum. That sounds like a muscle you pull at the gym. Like, I pulled my frustum doing deadlifts.
It does sound like that. But a frustum is essentially a pyramid with the top chopped off.
Oh, okay.
Imagine a bucket shape. Wide at the top, narrow at the bottom.
Oh.
Or the base of a statue. That's a frustum.
Why were they so obsessed with frustum?
Granaries.
Ah.
Think about it. If you build a silo to store grain, you often taper at the bottom so the grain flows out easily, or you taper it at the top for structural stability.
Right.
Calculating the volume of a regular box is easy, length times width times height. But a frustum, the sides are sloping, the area changes at every single vertical point.
Yeah, that seems really hard to calculate without modern calculus.
It is hard. And yet, nearly 4,000 years ago, the Egyptians had a working formula for it.
That's amazing.
They needed to know exactly how much grain was in the silo just by measuring the outside dimensions. They couldn't just climb in and count the kernels.
And the Reisner Papyrus, this one seems more practical. The notes say it talks about concrete units.
Right. The Reisner Papyrus is fascinating because it shows the sheer bureaucracy of ancient Egypt. They had tables for length, width, depth, and volume for blocks of material.
They needed this for construction and for storing grain.
Exactly. They actually derived their volume units from their length units, which is a very modern idea.
So they took the cubit, which is a length, and made a volume cubit.
You've got it. We know the cubit was based on the forearm length from the elbow to the tip of the middle finger.
Yeah.
So they had a volume cubit, which is 1 cubit by 1 cubit by 1 cubit.
Which is exactly how we define a cubic meter today, just with different lengths.
Exactly. They also had the volume palm and the volume digit.
A volume digit, so like a finger width cubed.
Essentially.
Hmm.
The math was simple. A volume digit is 1 cubit times 1 cubit times 1 digit. They were trying to create a system where they could calculate the volume of a granary or a stone block just by measuring the sides.
This wasn't just fill this pig's stomach.
No, this was geometry.
Speaking of geometry and famous ancients, we have to talk about the big one, Archimedes, the man, the myth, the streaker.
The streaker.
Well, the story goes he ran down the street naked yelling, "Eureka!" Right?
That is the popular legend, yes.
So the story we all learned in school is this. The king has a new golden crown. He suspects the goldsmith cheated him and mixed in some silver. He asks Archimedes to figure out if it's pure gold without scratching it.
Yeah.
Archimedes gets in a bath, sees the water rise, realizes that the volume of water displaced is equal to the volume of his body submerged.
Eureka moment.
Exactly. He yells Eureka, runs naked to the palace, dunks the crown, measures the water rise, compares it to a lump of pure gold, and catches the thief.
That is a wonderful story. It is dramatic, it's intuitive, and according to our sources, it is probably not how he actually did it.
You are crushing my childhood dreams here. Why not?
It really comes down to precision.
Mm-hmm.
The source explicitly mentions that the extreme precision required makes the water displacement method very difficult.
Okay, think about it.
A crown is a relatively small, intricate object. If you drop it into a bucket of water, the water level might rise, what, a millimeter? Half a millimeter?
Yeah, and if there is surface tension, the meniscus, where the water curves up the side of the bucket, it would be really hard to see the difference between the gold crown and the fake crown just by looking at the water level.
Exactly. The difference in volume between a pure gold crown and a slightly adulterated crown would be tiny. Trying to measure that vertical rise in a bowl of water would be prone to huge errors.
And Archimedes was a genius, so he would have known that.
He absolutely would have.
So what did he likely do instead?
The likely truth is he used a hydrostatic balance. This relies on Archimedes' principle, the idea of buoyancy, but it uses weight rather than volume measurement directly.
How does that work? Walk me through it.
Okay. You take the crown and you put it on one side of a scale. On the other side, you put a lump of pure gold that weighs exactly the same as the crown.
So in the air, sitting on his desk, the scale is perfectly balanced.
Okay, balanced in air. Now you lower the entire balance, both the crown and the gold lump, into a tank of water.
We're going underwater.
Yes. Now here's the physics. Archimedes' principle states that an object submerged in a fluid is buoyed up, pushed up, by a force equal to the weight of the fluid it displaces.
Okay, the water pushes back.
Right. Now, if the crown is pure gold, it has the same density and the same volume as the gold lump. They will displace the exact same amount of water.
So they will experience the same upward force.
Exactly. The scale will stay perfectly balanced underwater.
But if the crown has silver in it...
Silver is less dense than gold. Think of it as fluffier in atomic terms. So a crown mixed with silver would be physically bulkier.
It would have a larger volume than the pure gold lump, even if they weigh the exact same in air.
Larger volume means it pushes away more water.
And because it displaces more water, the water pushes back harder.
Exactly. It feels a stronger upward force, more buoyancy. So the scale would tip. The crown side would rise up.
That is so much smarter. You don't need to measure the water level with a ruler. You just need to see if the scale tips.
Precisely. It turns a measurement problem into a simple visual check. It's elegant, precise, and much more likely to be the method a mind like Archimedes would use.
I love that. It takes the same principle, volume displacement, but applies it in a way that actually works in the real world.
Right.
It transforms volume from how much space into how much force.
And that leads us perfectly into section two. Because Archimedes wasn't just dunking crowns, he was part of a long tradition of mathematicians trying to figure out how to calculate space.
So we are moving from the ancient struggle to the mathematics of space.
Yes.
This is where we get into the heavy hitters. Euclid, calculus, the stuff that makes high school students sweat.
It starts with Euclid's Elements around 300 BCE. This was the Bible of geometry for 2,000 years.
Euclid established the exact formulas for things like parallel pipeds, cones, and cylinders.
Right.
Parallelepipeds. I just like saying that word. It's basically a 3D parallelogram, right? Like a slanted box.
Correct. Euclid helped shift the perspective from measuring containers, you know, how much grain is in this jar, to calculating shapes.
It's a conceptual leap.
It is. Yeah. You stop looking at the stuff inside and start looking at the abstract boundaries of the object. But the real game changer came much later, in the early 17th century, with a man named Bonaventura Cavalieri.
Cavalieri, he sounds like a Renaissance artist.
He was an Italian mathematician and a Jesuit priest. And he came up with Cavalieri's principle. This is the intellectual bridge to calculus. Oh. He had this brilliant insight. He imagined that any 3D object is actually made up of an infinite number of incredibly thin 2D slices.
Like a loaf of bread.
Exactly like that.
Mm.
Or a stack of paper. Imagine you have a stack of paper that forms a perfect cube. Now, push the side of the stack so it slants over.
It looks like the Leaning Tower of Pisa now.
But has the volume changed?
No. It's the exact same amount of paper.
Precisely. The shape has changed, but the volume is identical because the area of each slice is preserved. Cavalieri formalized this.
He said if you slice a shape infinitely thin, you can calculate the volume of even very irregular objects by understanding the area of those slices.
Yes.
Thinner and thinner slices. That philosophy led directly to modern integral calculus, right?
It did. Pierre de Fermat, Isaac Newton, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, they all expanded on this idea.
Right.
When you take a calculus class today and you learn to find the area under a curve or the volume of a shape, you're essentially summing up an infinite number of these infinitesimally small slices.
The outline mentions solids of revolution and the washer method. I remember staring at these terms in my textbook and feeling a headache coming on. Can you explain that in plain English?
Sure. Imagine you have a piece of wire bent into a curve.
Okay.
If you twirl that wire really fast around a stick, it looks like a 3D shape, right? Like a ghost of a vise or a bowl.
Yeah. Looking at a spinning fan blade, it looks like a solid disk.
Exactly. That is a solid of revolution. Calculus allows us to calculate the exact volume of that shape. If the shape is solid, we use the disk method.
Okay.
But if the shape has a hole in the middle, like a donut or a thick pipe, we use the washer method.
Because a washer is just a flat disk with a hole in it.
Right. The formula basically calculates the volume of the outer shape and subtracts the volume of the inner hole.
Got it.
Mathematically, it looks like pi times the integral of the outer radius squared minus the inner radius squared.
Okay, let's not get too bogged down in the formula or I'll have flashbacks. But the point is, we went from this pig's stomach looks full to I can calculate the volume of a curve spun around an axis using infinite slices.
And we use that logic today for things that are incredibly complex. The source mentions a low poly triangle mesh of a dolphin.
A dolphin mesh. This is computer graphics, right?
Yes. In video games or 3D printing, a computer doesn't know what a dolphin is. It doesn't know smooth skin.
Right.
It defines a dolphin surface as thousands of tiny flat triangles connected together. This is called a polygon mesh.
So it looks like a low-res origami dolphin.
Exactly. To find the volume of that digital dolphin, say, to know how much plastic it will take to 3D print it, the computer uses algorithms based on that exact same principle.
It breaks the complex shape down into simple geometrical parts.
Pyramids connected to the center, usually, and sums them all up.
So the ancient Egyptians measured blocks with cubits, and we measured digital dolphins with polygons. Same concept, just way more data.
Exactly. The resolution has just gone from stone blocks to microns. But having the math is only half the battle.
Right, because you also need everyone to agree on what a one is. What is one unit?
And that brings us to section three. Standardization.
From kings to Krypton. This is the political history of volume.
And it is a messy history. If you look at the medieval period, the array of units was just confusing. The source lists the sester, the amber, the coom, and the seam.
I have never heard of a coom in my life.
The coom was a dry measure, mostly for grain. It was roughly 4 bushels.
Okay.
But the problem wasn't just the weird names. It was that a coom in one town might be completely different from a coom in the next town over. This variation caused chaos for trade.
Imagine trying to bake a cake where the recipe calls for a sester of flour, but your sester cup is half the size of the baker's.
Or more importantly, imagine paying taxes. If the king demands 100 seams of wheat and his seam is bigger than yours, you are in real trouble.
This is why Henry III of England stepped in.
The Assize of Bread and Ale in 1258.
This was a landmark statute. The notes say it standardized weight, length, and volume.
It did. It introduced the gallon and the bushel as legally defined units. It was basically consumer protection in the 13th century.
Why bread and ale, specifically?
Because that's what people lived on. The statute linked the price of bread to the price of wheat. But to do that, you needed to know exactly how much wheat was in a bushel.
If the bushel size varied, the price control wouldn't work at all.
Yeah, exactly. So standardization was actually a crucial form of economic regulation.
So kings were the original standards bureaus.
They had to be. Stability depended on it. I also see a note here about the London Pharmacopoeia in 1618. That's a medicine catalog.
Right. While bakers needed rough accuracy, apothecaries, medicine makers needed real precision.
Exactly. You can't be roughly right when mixing poisons and cures. They adopted the Roman gallon or congis as a basic unit.
This is where we see the uncertainty narrowing.
Yes. The source says around this time, precision improved to between 1 and 5 milliliters.
That is much better than the handful days. But the real revolution, pun intended, came with the French.
The French Revolution. 1795. The Enlightenment in action.
The French revolutionaries wanted to overthrow the king, but they also wanted to overthrow the irrationality of the old systems.
They wanted a system based on reason, not tradition.
Enter the metric system.
And they did it beautifully. They formally defined the metric system in French law using 6 units. 3 of them were strictly related to volume.
You had the stair, which was 1 cubic meter, specifically for measuring firewood.
Which is interesting that firewood was important enough to get its very own base unit.
Energy is always important. Then you had the liter, which was 1 cubic decimeter, for liquids.
And here is the genius part. They connected volume to mass. They defined the gram as the mass of 1 cubic centimeter of water at the melting point of ice.
That is the part that always blows my mind about the metric system. It's all connected.
Right.
Length defines volume. Volume of water defines mass. 1 cubic centimeter of water weighs 1 gram. It's so clean compared to how many ounces in a pound.
It created a cohesive system. Before this, length, volume, and mass were often completely separate systems with no mathematical relationship.
The French Revolution linked them all into one chain of logic based on water.
But even that wasn't precise enough for the modern world.
Yeah, the source mentions that in the 20th century, we had to redefine everything again.
We moved from kings to Krypton. See, the problem with defining a meter as this metal bar in Paris, the international prototype meter, is that metal bars change.
They expand when it's hot, they contract when it's cold.
They can corrode. If your standard changes, the whole universe of measurement wobbles.
So they look for something that never changes.
Atoms.
Oh.
In 1960, they redefined the meter based on the emission line of Krypton 86 atoms.
And then in 1983, and updated again in 2019, they went even further.
Right. Now, the definition of the meter, and therefore the cubic meter, is tied to the speed of light, and the second, which is based on a cesium standard.
So a meter is effectively the distance light travels in a vacuum in 1,299,792,458 of a second.
Exactly. The meter is no longer a physical object. It is a concept of physics.
This means volume is now anchored to the fundamental constants of the universe.
If aliens landed, they wouldn't know what a King Henry is. But they would know the speed of light. We could communicate our volume to them perfectly.
That is a long way from a pig stomach.
It certainly is.
Okay, let's move to section 4, capacity, precision, and derived quantities. Because we talked about the definition, but how do we actually use this stuff in the real world?
Let's do it.
And I want to go back to that tank example from the outline because it really confused me at first.
The petroleum tank example.
Mm.
This illustrates the difference between physical volume, the capacity, and the weak capacity.
Right. The source says a 50,000 barrel tank might hold 7,200 tons of fuel oil.
Yes.
But that same tank cannot hold 7,200 tons of naphtha. Why?
It comes down to density. Naphtha is a liquid hydrocarbon mixture, often used as a solvent. The key here is density.
Naphtha is lighter, less dense than fuel oil?
Correct.
So it's fluffier. Can I call a liquid fluffy?
In a sense, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It takes up more space for the exact same amount of weight. Think of it like popcorn versus lead.
Okay.
If you have a box that holds 10 pounds of lead and you try to put 10 pounds of popcorn in it, the popcorn will overflow long before you hit 10 pounds.
Because the popcorn takes up way more volume for the same weight.
Exactly. Naphtha takes up more space per ton than fuel oil. So the tank hits its volume limit. It physically fills to the brim before it hits the weight limit of 7,200 tons.
The constraint is the physical space, the volume.
That's a crucial distinction for logistics. You can't just look at the weight rating of a ship or a tank. You have to know the volume of the stuff you're putting in it.
And you need the right tools to measure that volume. The source draws a great contrast between the kitchen and the lab.
Yeah, calibrated measuring cups are fine for your Sunday pancakes, but they aren't science.
If you look at a kitchen measuring cup, the lines are printed on, the glass might be slightly warped. Being off by 5 milliliters won't ruin your cake.
But in a lab, being off by a microliter can completely ruin an experiment.
So what do they use?
They use things like volumetric flasks, which are specifically calibrated to contain a precise volume at a specific temperature.
Or the air displacement pipette.
Right. This is used in biology. It uses a piston to displace a specific volume of air, which then pulls up the exact same volume of liquid. We are talking about measuring fluids at the microscopic scale.
And on the flip side of that, you have the industrial scale. Those giant petroleum tanks holding 1 million barrels, that's 160 million liters.
And believe it or not, they measure those with extreme precision too. But at that scale, you have to account for things you totally ignore in the kitchen.
Like temperature.
Because liquids expand when they get hot.
Right. If you have 160 million liters of oil and the sun comes out and warms the tank by 10 degrees, that oil expands significantly.
The level goes up. You might think you have thousands of liters more than you actually do.
So industrial volume measurement is a complex calculus of density, temperature, and pressure.
You aren't just reading a dipstick. You are solving an equation.
It also mentions derived quantities in the notes. This is how volume helps us calculate other stuff.
Volume is a building block.
Yeah.
Once you have volume, you can calculate density, which is mass divided by volume.
You can calculate flow rate, how much volume passes through a pipe per second.
You can calculate specific volume, which is the inverse of density. Almost all engineering, how planes fly, how ships float, how engines run, relies on these derived quantities.
It really is the bedrock of how we describe the physical world.
It is.
So we've covered a lot. We've gone from ancient Egypt to modern physics. Let's wrap this up with our outro. What is the big takeaway here?
For me, the takeaway is that volume is the connector. It connects the abstract math, the geometry of Euclid and the calculus of Newton, to the messy physical reality of how much.
How much fuel, how much water, how much space.
We started with volume digits and pig bladders, desperate to just make trade work.
And now we use the speed of light to measure the volume of a digital dolphin mesh.
It's a testament to human ingenuity. We took a concept that nature didn't hand us a ruler for, and we built a ruler out of the universe itself.
That is a beautiful way to put it.
It's true.
But before we go, I want to leave you, the listener, with that final provocative thought from the source material. We live in a 3D world. We understand volume. But the math doesn't stop at three dimensions.
No, it doesn't.
The source mentions that 0, 1, and 2-dimensional objects have no volume. A line has length, but zero volume. A square has area, but zero volume.
But in 4 or higher dimensions, there is an analogous concept called hypervolume.
Hypervolume.
Just as volume measures the content of a 3D shape, hypervolume measures the content of a 4D shape. We can calculate it mathematically.
We can write the formulas for it.
We can tell you the hypervolume of a 4-dimensional sphere. But we cannot see it. Our brains are simply not wired to perceive it.
So if volume is our measure of reality in the space we actually live in, what exactly does hypervolume measure?
What is quantity in a dimension we can't even perceive?
That is the big question. And maybe, just maybe, our entire universe, our entire volume of space, the stars, the galaxies, your coffee cup, is just a thin slice.
A capillary slice.
The capillary slice of a much larger 4D hypervolume that we are just floating in.
It's entirely possible.
Now that is something to think about while you pour your morning coffee. Thanks for listening to this deep dive into volume. We will catch you on the next one.